are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
The Dragon Wars on Heaven and Earth. The Dragon Wars on Heaven and Earth. In John chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, John gives us a dramatic portrayal of redemptive history. In this portrayal, he speaks about this woman and this child and this dragon. And the woman, we learned, represents either God's people in general or the nation of Israel specifically, perhaps both. But the nation of Israel is definitely at least a part, if not the focus, of who this lady represents. And this reminds us as well, this woman, of what God said to Eve, the first lady, all the way back in Genesis 3, when he promised her after her sin that he would give an offspring to the woman that would produce somebody who would crush the head of the serpent. Genesis 3:15, the child then is Christ, and we spoke about that as well. And this would be the ultimate offspring of the woman, prophesied in Genesis 3. And though we know that Christ would come to deliver us in a spiritual sense from our sins, here at the beginning of Revelation 12, the focus is on restoring God's kingdom to earth. Something that also was lost. Not only was close fellowship with God lost through sin, but God's kingdom on earth was also set back through mankind's sin as well. And Christ will come to rule and reign and restore God's kingdom forever. The dragon then, we looked at him, and this is none other than Satan himself. That old dragon from the Garden of Eden. John describes that later in chapter 12. And another fascinating thing we looked at last week was how the dragon of this chapter climaxes this theme of snakes, serpents, and dragons, even sea dragons, from the book of Genesis all the way through the history of Israel. We talked about how this theme is used, this image is used to refer to Pharaoh and Egypt. Also, the Canaanites, the Philistines surrounding the nation of Israel and their influence on Israel. How this theme also represents nations like Babylon and Assyria. And then in the New Testament, Herod tried to take away the Messiah. And then what was the interesting shift in how this term was used? Do you remember this? Shifted from nations and empires conflicting with the seed, the offspring of the woman, to take out the Messiah. And it focused instead on describing the Pharisees and the Sadducees as the snakes and the serpents. And of course, eventually, rather than deceiving the Messiah and tempting him, we find that Satan took the approach of destroying him, and even that failed. And we looked in chapter 12 where it says that the dragon was trying to gobble up the child as soon as it was born. But when it was born, the kid got away and it ascended up to heaven. And that was the whoops. For all the drama, it turned out to be quite a dud of a story because Christ just ascended back to heaven in victory. And the dragon, of course, was furious. Now, from Revelation 12:5 to Revelation 12:6, we talked about this. Here's a picture that might help you envision this. We jump in history from the ascension of Christ in Revelation 12:5, which also is something that happens at the end of Daniel's 69th week, a prophecy that John refers to a lot, all the way to Revelation 12:6, Daniel's 70th week, and the events that are described in Daniel 12, verse 6, especially the last half of that week. And in between chapter 5 and chapter verse 5 and verse 6 is, and John doesn't talk about this, but is this entire period of the last days, or the church age is what we often call it. But the entire church age is, in New Testament terms, the last days. And that is the insert. But John is not focused on talking about the church. He is focused on the Messiah, the line, the nation of Israel, and Satan's battle against that. And that brings us to Revelation chapter 12 and verse 7. So, we are now talking again about this last half, the second half of Daniel's 70th week, the tribulation period, the final 7 years before Christ comes and establishes God's kingdom. During this period of time, it says in verse 6, the woman, Israel, fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days, or 3.5 years. And there will be a place we see somewhere in the wilderness outside Palestine where Israel, many believing Israelites, will run and be protected and fed and nourished by God. We'll talk about that also more tonight. Matthew 24, verses 15 through 21, Jesus himself spoke about this when he warned the Israelites, be very cautious. When the moment comes, midway through the tribulation, the Antichrist sits down and demands worship and then breaks the treaty with those who will not. That is the moment. Don't let an hour pass. You flee from Jerusalem and you run to the hiding place, or you will wish that you hadn't. That's Jesus' warning about the same period of time. So, Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 12, we find here that there is an expulsion in which Satan, or the dragon, is expelled from heaven completely. What is this speaking about? The real question I think we have when we read this, let's look at it. Verse 7, it says, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them, the brethren, before our God, day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. You could add the word but to get the idea here. But woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. People want to know, when did this war with the dragon happen? And that's a good question. Some suggest that this battle actually is kind of retrospective, and it's rewinding the reel all the way back to before the Garden of Eden, when Satan fell out of favor with God because of his rebellion. So does this refer to Satan's original fall out of favor with God? Others suggest that this occurred at the cross. And while Jesus was doing battle with sin on the cross, Michael the archangel was doing the battle for him in the heavenly sphere and was casting Satan out somehow at the crucifixion. Neither of these interpretations are crazy. Good people take these views. But I'm going to suggest that there is a difficulty with both of these interpretations. The difficulty is this, that both of them require Satan to have no place before God after either A, his fall at the beginning of time, or B, the crucifixion. But Scripture indicates that Satan does have access to God in heaven during this time. After his initial fall out of favor with God, Satan does have access to God in heaven in a certain way, all the way up until the tribulation period. Consider Job 1:6. This is some of the oldest, this may be the oldest book written in the Bible. It refers back to the period of Abraham, so very old. It says, the sons of God, a reference in this verse to angelic beings, came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan, and John has been very clear here in Revelation 12 to make sure we know who this dragon is. He's the deceiver, he's the devil, he's Satan. So he piles up the names here so that you understand who we're talking about. And Satan also came among them. Job chapter 2 and verse 1 tells us of a very similar event that happened during the life of Job. And in this moment, Satan appeared before God in heaven to accuse Job of potential disloyalty to God, to try to impugn his character, to undermine his righteous standing before God, and to show where he might be able to demonstrate that Job's faith was not genuine, to break this relationship that Job had with the Lord. So he appears kind of like a prosecuting attorney to produce evidence, or in some cases even to set up somebody so that he can come up with evidence that this person does not truly believe in God as it seems. The voice that John heard then from heaven in Revelation 12:10 says this. Fast forwarding to the tribulation period, the accuser of our brethren, who accused them, our brethren. These are people who, at the very least, were martyrs during the early parts of the tribulation period. Could refer to the entire tribulation and last days, the church age. Could refer to all of redemptive history. It doesn't really matter, because the most basic answer requires this to be something that happens in the tribulation period. The accuser of our brethren, who accused them, where? Before God, day and night, has been cast down. So, if this heavenly battle, where Satan is expelled from heaven and no longer has a place in heaven, occurred before Eden, then how did Job 1:6 and 2:1 occur? How else do you describe what Satan was doing? And how do you describe him doing any such thing, appearing before God in his presence to accuse the brethren in any way, if he had no ability to come into God's presence? It's very difficult to do that. And so from that very point, it seems most likely that this is indeed a battle that will occur in heaven, in the heavenly realm, spiritual realm, during the tribulation, the second half of the tribulation, about the midpoint of the tribulation. It's a future battle that will occur. Another connection that makes this likely is that Daniel, you could look at Daniel 12:1. Daniel identifies Michael there, and in a couple of other places in the Old Testament book of Daniel, He identifies Michael, the archangel, in particular as having responsibility to stand over, to watch over, to guard, to protect, to care for the nation of Israel. He is essentially, to use terms we might understand, the guardian angel of the nation of Israel. That's his job. The Secretary of Defense from heaven for Israel. Something of that nature. Notice Daniel 12:1. At that time, so this is some end times prophesying Daniel is doing. At that time, Michael shall stand up. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, Israel. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And so this seems to be a reference to this very same time in which Michael will come to action on behalf of the nation of Israel at that very time when there will be a great tribulation that no nation has ever experienced to that degree in history. That coupled with the fact that Satan does have, we see this with Job, we see this in other places, access to heaven today and in the past, indicates this was not Satan's original fall. This is a battle that will occur in the heavenly realm between Satan and the other angels. So, the short on this is that Satan and his fallen angels, and we learned this last week, he has a third of the angelic realm, and Michael, God, they have two-thirds. So imagine, if you can, a risk board, right? On the board of risk, you have your players all laid out, the cavalry and the tanks, and or the cannons, and the people, soldiers. One-third is black, and two-third is gold. Those are the playout. And so the game begins, and the battle is set, and Satan gets the first move, and he unleashes his fury on the heavenly angels. And he loses. And gets kicked off of Asia and Europe. And he gets relegated down to the southern parts of the board. That's essentially what's happening. He loses that battle. He gets cast out of the heavenly realm with his angels. He gets cast down to the earth, expelled from heaven so that he doesn't have any pieces anywhere left in that realm. He's gone. He's been evicted. He's been removed. And he's not even allowed to come back. It's emphasized here in this passage that it's not just that he is removed. It says that the one who accuses the brothers has been removed. That's kind of the big deal. Apparently, in the heavenly realm, it is a common experience, day or night, which means when we're sleeping or when we're awake, it doesn't really matter because in heaven, that doesn't really matter. 24/7. In our time, Satan is doing prosecutorial attorney work. He is always accusing. He is always trying to bring new evidence and open up the case file on any of God's people that he can. We see how he did this with Job. He's looking for evidence. He's trying to demonstrate a chink somewhere here that this is not what it looks like it is. Some of the good angels, when the good angels looked at and marvel at the redemption that we have, and yet Satan is trying to make a case that's not what it looks like. These people are not what they appear to be. I mean, I just look at what they do. I mean, I can show you. There are times in Paul's teaching where he refers to this, that we are living our lives not only, remember Ephesians spoke about this, not only for the human world to see, but the heavenly realm is watching us. And Satan's producing evidence why it's not what it seems. And so they're used to Satan making regular appearances over there and accusing us all the time. Here he comes again. Here he comes again. He has nothing but negative things to say all the time about God's people. the stuff that they do and say, apparently, and it is very negative. That's what he does. And so when he comes in for a battle, well, he gets kicked out. And a voice from heaven says, "Good riddance! The prosecutor is gone! He's not going to be coming up here anymore accusing the brothers. Thank you." Now, how did people overcome this? How do we as God's people, how do any of God's people make it through the intense scrutiny that he puts us through in heaven day and night? Today we had a presidential election. I hope it's more placid than the last 4 years. The last 4 years was nothing but one big series and run of litigations. Who knows if they were legitimate or not? I don't think we'll ever know that. But that's what it was. One hearing after another. One trial after another. One investigation after another. And the case would close. Oh, new evidence. We have new things. It just incessant. And it wears you down. To the point where you just want it to stop. Whether it's right or wrong, you just want it to stop. That's what Satan does. But how do we overcome this? I mean, do you want your life to be run through by the FBI and CIA for 4 solid years with the whole world watching what they have to show you? I don't want my life run through like that. Well, that's what happens to you apparently in heaven. Apparently your case file is always being opened and dug through, and fresh evidence is being provided why you should not be God's child. Why you're on the wrong side. You actually should be moved back to Satan's side. You were a piece that got put on the wrong team accidentally. It needs to be put back on his side. And he probably has good evidence. It's probably why he works so hard. Because he feels like he has a winning case. But it says that they overcame him. By what? The blood of the Lamb. Everything he produces it, and God says, "Covered in red, my friend. I see nothing but the blood of my Son." What is that you say? I don't see that. I just see the blood of Christ there smeared over that thing. What did you say? He said, "There's no record of it up here." That sounds like a bogus record to me, because it's not here in the courts of heaven. That's the idea. I mean, just think about it. Last week, did you do or say anything that would give him fresh evidence to make the case open against you again? I mean, that should make us nervous. That should make us sit on the edge of our seat and say, "I hope this one doesn't do it. I hope this one didn't prove it. I hope this activity did not demonstrate, you know." And to a certain degree, sometimes we are simply just professing and it's not real. I understand that. But we're talking about genuine believers here. That's what Satan is after. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. That's the secondary evidence. The good things that we do that there's no explanation for. There are things that we do and say in particular that give evidence that we are his children. We do believe in him. We do follow Christ, despite evidence to the contrary as well. But that is covered by the blood of the Lamb. And everything else shouldn't even occur. We shouldn't say anything positive about Christ. We shouldn't follow him. We shouldn't produce any good works. And so that also is evidence for us. And so this moment is a moment of celebratory good riddance. The prosecutor of God's people is gone. That's exciting. That's the good news. It's an exciting time in heaven, but it's not an exciting time on earth. Notice the significant change here. "Rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell there," in the heavens, but "woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the seas." Why? Because you get him now 24/7, and he has nowhere else to go. The prosecutor is on the loose permanently, down there. So Satan is banished to earth. He will be furious, infuriated, because he has no outlet. He can't even make a case in heaven anymore. So now all he can do is go to simply destroy God's people and stamp them out through destruction. Deception is now no longer in the playbook. So he will now concentrate his full effort and strength on earth. If you think he's doing that now, well, think again. He's got split attention. He is a double-minded angel right now. Between heaven and earth, working his cases. But when that is done, it'll be full fury on earth and nothing held back. Not just because he will be banished to earth and furious, concentrating all efforts there. He will also know, as John says, he knows that his time is running out. When the door shuts to his office in heaven, he knows the clock is ticking now. So, he will be upset. His window of time to overthrow and derail God's kingdom will be closing. For that reason, verses 13 to 17 show us how Satan will intensify his persecution of God's people on earth. He'll concentrate his fury against God, since he doesn't have access to God, on the woman who gave birth to the male child, the one that got away from him. Another evidence of his perpetual failure. Satan really is the bad guy in the movie that has great plans to take over the world, but they always collapse. And each one gets more complicated and sophisticated and scary, and then it always just collapses. And this is what's happening to him. This woman who gave birth to the male child in this telling of the story is, of course, Israel on earth and the people of God. John has already foreshadowed in Revelation 12:6 that for the second half of the tribulation, the people of God will flee Israel to a place of safety in the wilderness. This is brought up again here in Revelation 12 a second time. God will provide his people with this place of protection and provision outside Palestine. And this time, John doesn't say for 1,260 days. He says for a time and times and half a time, which is borrowing language for the same period of time from the book of Daniel. You can look in Daniel 7:25 to see this. Now, a time, times and half a time. If you think of that as numbers, a time, hold up one finger. Now, make that plural on your other hand. Double it. Okay? A time, two times, and then what's half a time? Like that, right? What is that? It's three and a half. It's three and a half. Well, what is three and a half? Well, it's 12,060 days. Well, what is that? It's 3.5 years, the second half of Daniel's 70th week. Some Bible interpreters will say and suggest that this is a reference now to 3.5 year or so period of time when Israel will hide in Petra, which is the ruins of the ancient city of Edom, carved out of the rock. The prophet Obadiah prophesies to Edom in the Old Testament. These arrogant people who dwell in a very difficult place to attack. And so because of that, they feel like they're eagles up in the sky and no one can get them. And they're arrogant and proud way up there. And they'll suggest that they're going to kind of refurbish, restore Petra. It's a fascinating possibility. You could find documentaries online about this, but at the end of the day, what am I going to say? Well, what does the Bible say? It doesn't say it's this. We don't know that it's this. We just know that in the wilderness outside Palestine, the believing people of Israel will flee Jerusalem to a place in the wilderness that God will prepare for them. And they will be fed there and protected during this time. That's really all we know. We know enough from the Old Testament to say that God can do whatever he wants. He could build a brand new castle out there for him if he wants. He could have a bunker out there overnight just because he spoke it into existence. God can do whatever he wants, whether it's a refurbished, fixed up Petra or not. We don't know. But there'll be a place in the wilderness for his people. To further describe this place and what is going to happen, it says in Revelation 12:14, I like this, the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. The serpent is a figurative dragon, right? That's Satan. This doesn't mean that Israel's going to all jump onto some big jetliner and fly out to this place on a stealth bomber or something like this. It's using figurative language to describe God's care of his people. And to do so, John borrows from some well-known Old Testament prophetic imagery that we may already know about that is special to Israel. Exodus 19:4. This is how God described his protection of Israel when he brought them out of Egypt in slavery. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians. Again, these are the serpent people, right? Part of the hiss of the serpent in history against God's people. How I bore you on eagle's wings, taking you away from Egypt, from that serpent, right? And brought you to myself. I think it's a beautiful picture here of what Israel would recognize as this kind of imagery that God has referred to in the Old Testament repeatedly, of his care for them. How he lifted them up, carried them far above their struggle, and took them to this safe place up in the rocks or in the wilderness. There's also the verse that we know quite well. Maybe you're thinking about it. I'll show it to you in a second. But this verse is given to us. We quote it a lot today when we're feeling tired, exhausted, beat up from a long day at work or struggling against temptation and just old age or whatever it might be. That's not exactly what that verse is given to speak about directly. In fact, if you look at Isaiah chapter 40 and you study its context, you realize that God is speaking to the nation of Israel, telling them that whatever fears they had about world empires besieging them, attacking them, overtaking them, overpowering them, taking them captive, threatening to destroy them, to persecute them in the future. Israel has a little bit of a history being persecuted by other empires. And when this was given, they had enough experience to know they didn't want to go through it again. But they also realized, according to the prophets, they were going to have to go through this again in the future. How many times can you take that as a nation? And so here's what God told them. Despite all of that, those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Wait on the Lord. Empires come and empires go. World rulers rise and world rulers fall. But at the bottom of the totem pole through all the upheaval of history is usually God's people. And God says to his people, Israel in particular, just wait. Just wait. And I will give you the strength that you need to endure these things. That imagery is brought up for us, I believe, again, here in Revelation 12. Here in this passage, John describes something next that is clear and visual clear and vivid from a visual standpoint. Let me just read it to you. It says this. It's kind of interesting, right? The woman will be given two wings, the great eagle. She might fly into the wilderness as God's care and protection for his people. But then it says, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood. Now, again, this isn't a little snake writhing on the dunes. This is a massive, seven-headed, red, fiery dragon that is the big boss at the end of the story that is bigger than the screen itself. He is so scary. And he pours out water from his mouth. It says this water will come flooding and rushing out of his mouth. And his intention here is that he might cause the woman, God's people, to be carried away by this flood, or this river, this deluge. But the earth helped the woman. Again, this is they keep slipping through my fingers. The earth helped the woman open its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Now, I can't help but think again back to Egypt, when Moses threw down his rod and had a snake, and the magicians threw down their snakes from their rods. And what happened to their snakes? Moses' snake took its mouth and opened up and ate their snakes. Here, just the imagery, I think, is ironic, at least dramatically repeated, that this dragon, the greatest serpent at the end, unleashes this flood. Think about this strategically. How did God overthrow Satan's attempts through Egypt? One snake swallowing other snakes was the beginning of that story. That was just the preface. The conclusion was the armies of Egypt running through the Red Sea on dry land, and the sea swallowed them up. So perhaps Satan here, this is my imagination, but it's not too crazy, I don't think. It's just using the words. Satan may say, I'm going to try that one. They're running out on the dry land. I'm going to swallow them up with water. That worked on me last time. And what happens? The dry land opens up its mouth and swallows up the water. Now, if you're Satan, this is extremely infuriating. If you're us, it's kind of funny. The boss gets bigger and badder, and the strategies get smarter and more sophisticated, and every single time, oops, fail. And that's what happens. Now, what is actually going on here? Again, that's the question we want to ask, right? This might actually be describing an attempt of some kind to unleash some kind of torrential water source on this hiding place, to flood those rats out of the ground, so to speak, to get God's people to come scurrying for dry air or fresh air. I don't know what kind of technology or what kind of irrigation techniques that would require. Maybe that's what's being described. It's possible. But another possibility also is that this is, again, figurative language, which was very much used in this story, that is describing a military campaign of great size and force. Jeremiah 46:8 does a similar thing. Jeremiah is speaking again about Egypt. Egypt rises up like a flood, and its waters move like the rivers. And he says, I will go up and cover the earth, and I will destroy the city and its inhabitants. Then again, in Jeremiah 47:2, and this is speaking about Egypt coming down and taking out other towns around Egypt. Behold, waters rise out of the north, and shall be an overflowing flood, and they shall overflow the land and all that is in it, the city and those who dwell within. And if you read the context, he's not talking about rain. He's talking about the armies of Egypt. Daniel 11:26 uses similar terminology. So the idea in prophetic literature that waters rising up, rivers overflowing the land and wiping things out, is often used to describe massive hordes of destructive armies in a large campaign. Which is it here? I don't know. I can't say which it is. All I can say is it's one of these two things, and either one of them is scary. Either one of them gets the point across, and that's this. The clear point is that no matter what is going on, Satan is attempting a full, all-out assault on God's people in the hiding place that he gave to them, where he's nourishing them and taking care of them, and Satan is going after them. And yet again, he's hindered by natural, though miraculous, circumstances outside of his control. He goes to heaven with his one-third of the armies, and he gets kicked out. He goes to earth, and he goes after God's people, and they get a hiding place that he can't touch them. If you're thinking about that risk board again, he is now in Australia. And there's gold pieces on every other country. What's he going to do now? He's going to roll those dice till they turn to fire. He's, what am I going to do? And so here's what he does. He goes to the only other place he can. He says, so I'm going to make war with the rest of her offspring. I'll find other people of God and go after them. Who are these people? Other believing Jews outside the hiding place. It seems that this is a possibility. It seems that not all believing Jews will get to the hiding place before it's sealed. And so that's a possibility. Another possibility, as this is referring to Gentile believers who are still around on the earth. Maybe that's what the offspring is referring to. Or it could be both. And since there's nothing here that strongly requires one or the other, the safest, pun intended, the safest answer is probably just any other believers, Jews or not, who are not in the hiding place, who are out there with a testimony for the Lord and a bit unprotected. Satan got kicked out of heaven. He can't go to God to accuse anybody. He can't even fight the good angels anymore. He's trying to go after the hiding people of God, and they're all protected, so now he has to go to the rest that are out, laying around the board with no one to help them, he thinks. And that's where this chapter ends. We don't get the rest of the story yet. We're just left with this image in our mind of the other random followers of God out there, not in the hiding place, and Satan is going after them with his full fury because everything else he's failed to do. Revelation 13, you might be peeking ahead. Well, does that tell us? Well, Revelation 13 kind of goes back to the same story, but introduces us to the human face of the story. We've seen now the behind-the-scenes imagery of the dragon, Satan. But in Revelation 13, we're going to kind of get the same story rewinded and replayed, but looking at it through the activities of the Antichrist, whom Satan will empower, and the false prophet, whom will be unleashed. And we'll talk about that next week. But let's finish with some takeaways. Since the events that John describes here in Revelation 12 occur in the future, in the tribulation, in particular to the nation of Israel, what good do they do for us now besides make us think, oh, that was a pretty neat story, actually? First of all, we should think this way. Compared to future suffering that we just read about, our suffering is going to be small in this life. No matter how bad it gets. Last 4 years, some Christians thought it was getting bad. Now there's other Christians right now that think that the end has come in the next 4 years. That's going to be like that in the next 4 years too, one way or the other. So just figure that out. Whatever we suffer, and right now, I'm sorry, friends, getting kicked off for posting random stuff on Facebook is not persecution. It is not. It is not persecution. Seriously. Think about it this way. When a father asks his elementary age son to take a bag of groceries or a 2-gallon jug of milk up the stairs, put it in the refrigerator, that kid, it would not be uncommon halfway up the stairs to say, "Oh, my arm hurts. I can't do it. Dad, my arm hurts. I can't take it all the way up to the top." And what does the dad say? "Oh, my poor son, I'm so sorry for asking you to do something so difficult. I don't want your arm to hurt. Set that jug down and I will help you." Is that what he does? No. Usually the wise and mature and very impatient dad says something brilliant like, "Son, if you think that hurts, wait till you get older. Then you'll find out what hurts. 2-gallon of milk, my foot." Maybe that dad will give him another gallon and say, "Get him down here and do it again." But isn't that what we do? We complain about the things we suffer in this life. We find other Christians who agree that it's awful and horrible. And then we ask the big, scary question, why does God let bad things happen to good people like me? And God says, "You think that's something? Read the book of Revelation, my friend." That's what we're talking about. The book of Revelation is like that. It's God saying, "You think you have something? I'll show you something, and you should be glad you don't have to go through this." And we're not talking about God's wrath on ungodly people right now. We're talking about Satan's fury on God's people will be unprecedented. Really hard to say this, but if I'm talking to Jewish people and I say, "Look, if you have any conception of what the Holocaust was like, that will pale in comparison to what this will be like." That's the fury of which we are talking about. When we look at this story and we realize that the wrath that will be unleashed and will be further described later on God's people in the tribulation, that second half, will be unprecedented. As Daniel 12 said, no nation in the history of the earth will have faced what they will face. We should look at it and say, "I'll take my 2-gallon jug of milk, please. Let me sign up for some more of this suffering, because it's nothing." So we read the book of Revelation and we should be encouraged that what we think hurts is really just a pinprick. We also should read this story and realize that when we suffer for Christ. Did you notice here in this passage how that it's Christ, it's the Messiah, it's God, it's the child who was born? That's what Satan wants to get to. That's who he wants to take out. But when he can't go and take him out, who does he go after as a result? That child's followers. Because that's, in his view, the quickest way to the child. You study stories like the Holocaust, and you understand this. You couldn't get the person in charge of the family. What do? Get some people that they love, mistreat them, and then see what happens. And that's what Satan's tactics are. They're dragon tactics. That's what they are, to destroy, to devour. And that's what he does. Friends, there's a lesson here for us as well. We suffer for Christ. You can look around at the world and you can realize that, look, if I did not follow Christ, if I did not identify with Christ, if I did not associate with Christ and obey Christ, if I was not loyal to Christ, doing what Christ has told me to do, I could have an easier life. I could have more friends. I could have more money, I could be more liked and popular, and it could be a little easier for me. I could do more things. Well, that's a possibility, but we have to decide, do I want to have my suffering lifted now, but suffer forever in eternity? or suffer for the one who died for me now and be delivered in God's kingdom forever. Take your pick. I'll take the suffering now. Don't be fooled by the people who are ungodly, who are not identifying with Christ. Don't be fooled by the enjoyment and the freedom that they have or seem to have. Remember, Satan, the one they follow, is a deceiver, a liar, a murderer, and a killer. He's got them in the bag. That's why he doesn't do anything to them. Not like God's people. It's we he seeks to destroy now. So don't be deceived. Let's stay on the side of the one who was slain, the Lamb slain for our sins, because he, as Revelation says, is the Lion who comes to conquer. We stay on that side, even when they keep beating us up for it. Stay on that side. Suffer, because your sufferings are sharing in the sufferings of our Savior. That is a sacred and a special thing. Do not run away from that. Finally, we overcome Satan's accusations through our testimony for Christ. I mentioned this earlier in the study, so I won't belabor it now. But from one angle, we can ask the question, how much fresh evidence are you giving to Satan to reopen your case file in heaven? Let's try to reduce the stack. We're not going to be perfect from now to heaven. I understand that. But let's reduce the stack of evidence that we're misbehaving, that we're indicating we might not be loyal to Christ. Every time we complain, every time we give in to the desires of the flesh, every time we hurt another person or we disobey one of Christ's commands, anytime we show a lack of love for God or a lack of love for neighbor, we are giving Satan fresh evidence that we are in the wrong records, that we belong on his side. And so that requires him to appear in heaven to make his case against us again. And the sacrifice and the blood of Christ must be reminded of again. There's a sense in which it sacrifices Christ again, not in real time, but in retrospect, it makes his death more painful retrospectively and the sacrifice more necessary, and he's glad to do it. But I don't want to do that. Let's make sure that our lives are being lived in loyalty to our Savior. Our words are chosen to remove the ammunition that Satan has. May we not only rely on the blood of the Lamb as an excuse to misbehave, because I really don't want to keep appearing in court up there all the time. Let's give fresh evidence of our loyalty to our Savior. And when suffering comes, let's step forward and accept it.